blazer. Dr. Blazek. Can you hear me, Dr. Hero?
Yeah, Sherry, I can hear you. I'm not sure if Dr. Blazek or could hear you because I see that he's on, but it's
okay. Well, I'll start again.
Yeah.
Hero.
Yes.
Bagai.
Here.
Blazek.
I'll text Dr. Blazek.
Thank you. Brady.
Here.
Brownstein. Christensen.
Yes.
Jermaine.
Present.
Laut.
Here.
Snell.
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, agenda item number two, review, discussion, and possible action on committee meeting minutes. I'll make a motion that we approve the open session minutes from October 4th.
I will second that.
We have a motion and Dr. Laut seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes, none opposed. Agenda item number three, notice of proposed rulemaking. Jessica, are you on with us?
Can you guys hear me?
We can.
Wonderful. Yes, I am here.
Great. I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Give me 1 second. And did we want to work off the draft? I believe it was Dr. Laut who sent it over.
Sure.
Okay. Give me 1 second to pull that up.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear now.
Okay, welcome, Dr. Blazek.
Sorry about that. So I'll use my phone, I guess. Does that work?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. And I'll just mute myself.
Okay. And did we want to just pick up where we left off last time, or did we need to back up Dr. Laut for anything that you wanted to talk about?
No, I think the changes, this is Laut, I think the changes that I made highlighted in blue are the 1303 section. It's right after what we talked about last time, so should be pretty straightforward.
Okay, then I will share.
Okay, so there was talk last time about adding the emergency drugs to the document, and I just basically took what we have on the 1303 evaluation form and put them in under emergency drugs. One change, since it was listed as narcotic antagonist, I just changed that to opioid antagonist.
So I'm thinking if we add this in here, we would want to go back on the other permits and create a list as well for consistency. Jessica, would you recommend that? And committee members, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I would recommend it.
For the 1301 permit, I think the list has to be a bit larger. Because we include antihypertensives, hypotensive agents in there as well. We also include muscle relaxant.
Jessica, do you have our packet for this meeting?
I believe so.
So if you look at page 50, it should say section 1301, general anesthesia and deep sedation office forms. That lists what the current requirements are for a permit holder to have in the office. Dr. Snow?
I was just going to echo if I think we should. Dr. Blazek's right. They're different for each of the permits based off of what the papers are for that site evaluation. So we should just stick to whatever the site evaluation paperwork has for the respective permit levels is what I would recommend. I do have one question since we're it kind of is on that topic of for the 1302 permit holders, if we're going to do these drugs and list them out in this section, on the current for the site evaluation, it's required that 1302 permit holders have succinyl choline. Most 1302 permit holders, I would say, are uncomfortable for good reason, administering succinyl choline. I'd expect none of them to ever do that. So I think it brings up the point is, do we really want to require that of 1302 promoters if they've never been trained in how to use it? And is that even create more unsafety for those individuals in those offices?
Dr. Brady.
I agree with Heath on this one.
Yeah, so right now, with regard to the office forms, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the drugs listed for 1301 and 1302 are identical. So the recommendation would be to remove number four, muscle relaxant, off of the 1302. Keith, is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, Anthony, that's correct. All the other ones I think are great and fine, and they should have the knowledge and how to use those appropriately. But the succinyl choline with 1302 might have not received training to adequately handle that to them.
Anybody object to that? So, Jessica, we're looking, and you may see it, but it's the 1301 office form is on 50 and 1302 is on 58. number four under emergency drug muscle relaxant. That's the suggestion right now would be to keep them identical with the exception of that number four, remove it under the 1302 list of emergency drugs.
Sorry, can you guys hear me now?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So you said remove number four from 1302?
Yes. The title is muscle relaxant.
Okay.
Ryan?
And did you want to go with Dr. Lout's recommendation to change the on the form that's on the meeting, it's letter C, and on the pages in the packet 50 and 58, it's number 5, but it says narcotic antagonist. Do you want it to be opioid? Is that, do you want to take that recommendation or?
I think that's fine. My only question, and I would defer to, you know, Dr. Brady and Dr. German and the other anesthesiologists, the providers here, you know, and Heath also, Dr. Snell. So at a 1302 level, certainly the likelihood of a laryngeal spasm is not as great as it is for a general anesthetic, but you know, taking the succinylcholine off, that is your last, you know, ditch effort to try to break a laryngeal spasm. Can anyone else comment? I guess, you know, is the likelihood so rare that they don't really need to carry that?
Heath or Bray, I don't know who had their hand up first.
I'll let Jason go first. He can probably speak more educated to it, and then I'll hit you with opinion.
Go ahead, Jason.
That's okay. So, you know, I do teach a moderate sedation course, and we don't teach paralytics, and I don't think it's taught in a lot of the courses. I think the problem with paralyzing someone in that circumstance is that they're not supposed to be in a conscious level to begin with. And I think them trying to manage an airway where they don't manage airways that often to a paralyzed patient is going to be counterproductive in rescue. I think the big emphasis for rescue at that point is going to be oxygenation, ventilation, early EMS, and reversals, reversing those drugs and getting them out of that sedated state if they're using reversible drugs. And so, you know, that's where we get in kind of the minutia of things of different drugs which don't have reversals, such as like propofol, and the reasons behind precluding that. And so I think I just don't think they're educationally qualified to be ventilating a paralyzed patient. And I think it's probably going to be more detrimental if the first time they've ever paralyzed a patient is this type of rescue.
And for context, I'm wondering if this was originally, if a muscle relaxant was listed under 1302, because at one point, 1302 permit holders weren't precluded from using propofol as long as it was maintained in the moderate level. I think it was the last anesthesia and sedation committee that put it in rule that listed barbiturates, propofol, and ketamine can't be used. So this may just be part of cleanup since that's been done. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense to eliminate it.
If can I real quick, Andy? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
So just to Dr. Blazek, your point, I think that would be the main reason for a 1302 provider to use succinylcholine. From my personal experience and from what I've, just my own experience, I've never seen a laryngeal spasm. And if there were to happen one in a 1302 provider's hands, I think if they can't break it with what we can teach them and what they should have already learned in their courses, doing the succinylcholine isn't going to help at all in that situation. So to me, it's of no benefit. It could only make it worse. It won't make it any better for those 1302 providers. It may break the laryngeal spasm, and they won't know what to do for the most part, and just make the entire situation worse.
So, I mean, it sounds like everybody's in agreement with this. I don't know if we need to belabor it any longer. Jessica, you want to keep us moving along?
Sure. So I think what I got from that discussion was that you guys do want to remove the muscle relaxer from 1302, but I believe it stays maintained in 1301, if that's correct. My next question, someone mentioned changing opioid antagonist to narcotic antagonist.
It'd be the other way around, Jessica, changing narcotic to opioid.
Okay.
Any comments by committee members on that, if it should be listed as opioid or narcotic? Jason?
I just wanted to recognize we have Jeffrey Brownstein with us as well.
Thank you.
To our court.
Is narcotic antagonist more broad than opioid?
Jason?
The correct term is just opioid antagonist. Narcotics is kind of a slang word for just grouping of drugs that cause addiction. So opioid antagonist is what that drug really is.
Okay.
So that should, Jessica, that should probably be updated then in the 1301 and 2 list as well, because currently on the office form, I think it lists narcotic.
Okay. Any further discussion then on the emergency drugs? Okay. It looks like the next change was to remove the precordial / pretracheal stethoscope.
Yeah, this is loud again. I did that because that's mentioned a little further down under ventilation monitoring. So we're kind of repeating it twice.
Okay. And so likewise, remove it from any mention in 301 and 302 as well. I'm assuming that they are tracking similarly with this language.
Ollie?
Yeah, just why are we removing AED?
We're not removing AED.
We're just
abbreviating. Right, we're just removing the parentheses. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't understand. So we're saying that a cardiac defibrillator could be an AED. That's okay.
Yeah, I guess we probably should take the parentheses off of AED.
That's what we're doing.
Okay.
So was that a yes, that I should remove precordial and pretracheal stethoscope from 301 and 302 if it's mentioned there?
Here it's mentioned twice, I think, is the issue. I don't recall if it's mentioned twice on 1301, and that's what we'd have to check. We have to go back and look as far as equipment.
Okay. So would the preference then be to add in this red language about the ventilation monitor and remove the precordial and pretracheal stethoscope and make sure that both of those changes are made if necessary in 301 and 302?
I think that would be correct. This is Blazek, yeah.
Okay.
Jessica, you're...
Sorry, did I miss something?
This is Blazek again. I'm reading the 1301 permit requirements, and actually all I see is that we require to have entitled CO2. We don't have in there to have precordial or pretracheal stethoscope.
Heath, you've got your hand up.
Sorry, Anthony, I meant to disconnect that. My bad.
Well, it looks like the precordial, pretracheal stethoscope was new language that was being considered to be added to this anyway. And instead of adding that, it looks like the newest recommendation is to add, what is that, little 15?
Yes.
So do we want to do the same thing in 301 and 302 and require the ventilation monitor, pretracheal or precordial stethoscope or end-tidal capnography?
Well, the difference is in the 1301, you must have end-tidal capnography. That's basically the law, you know, for anyone doing deep sedation, general anesthesia. So if you're going to add it to 1301, you must have two separate Roman numerals. I think you'd have to have end-tidal capnography, and then your next one would be a secondary method, if you're going to do it, a secondary method for monitoring ventilation. And you could leave it like that, I would think, if you wanted to go back to 1301.
You'll just want to change the or to end. Correct, Randy?
Yeah, you can't, because when you do the general anesthesia, you have to have end-tidal in this state.
I remember us having this conversation. I think in 1301, we were saying you must have end-tidal CO2, period. So there's no mention of pretracheal, precordial, but the conversation under 1303 was that it would be acceptable for them to have pretracheal, precordial, or end-tidal CO2, right? So.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're okay, you know, leaving it either way, but definitely you want to have the differentiation there. You must have end-tidal on 1301.
Correct.
And just looking at what we do in the hospital, it's pretty common that we don't use, pretracheal or precordial. We just use end-tidal and pulse oximeter. So I'm fine with leaving it like it is, I think.
Heath?
Just maybe for Jessica's help and what Dr. Blazek was saying. So in the 1301, I wouldn't think you'd want to replace the ORs with ANDs, because that would imply that the 1301 provider would need all of those. When Dr. Blazek is just saying, you need the CO2. If a provider wants the other ones, that's okay. But what should be delineated in this rule is that it's a end-tidal CO2 monitor for that ventilation monitor.
Got it.
If the use of end-tidal is required for a 1301 and the use of precordial is optional, why would we even list precordial in the rule?
I don't think you should.
Agreed.
So for this one, we don't need an end-tidal ventilation monitor, pretracheal or precordial stethoscope?
No, so under 1301, only end-tidal CO2 and not even mention pretracheal precordial. For this section, I think the way it's worded is appropriate.
Okay.
Jason?
I've been in cases, not many, but some with deep sedation where the pretracheal stethoscope is superior to end-tidal CO2 by far. I mean, it's a ventilatory monitor, so actually the only monitor that will have zero latency and pick up fluids in the airway. So I'm a little bit perplexed. I mean, I use end-tidal CO2 almost 99% of the time. I get it. I understand the value, but at the same time, there are indications for other type of ventilatory monitors, and sometimes there's indication for both. So I don't know why we want to get into the weeds of this specifying the exact type of ventilatory monitor, but you know, I don't do that many deep sedations, but sometimes when I do, and title's not that great, I'm using a pretracheal stethoscope.
I mean, I think just because, like, a provider can make that choice, right? So as the rules go, I think saying for 1301 you must have end-tidal CO2, that's not precluding someone from also choosing to use pretracheal or precordial. Right?
No, I guess there's my point. I'm doing a deep sedation, and for whatever reasons, I'm not getting great CO2 tracings, but I have a great pretracheal stethoscope. Am I out of compliance? I'm using a ventilatory monitor. That's my point, I guess. If we're specifying you must have this monitor, it almost, to me, reads that you must be utilizing that monitor during those levels of permit.
I think
But wouldn't you still be using the end-tidal CFD? You just know you don't have a good waveform, so you're choosing to also use an additional monitoring device, but you'd still have the end-tidal CO2, you know, sampling line connected to the nasal cannula. So you'd still be using it. You just, as a clinician, know this isn't working well, so I'm going to use another instrument.
Dr. German?
I was just going to say, you know, one of the problems with general anesthesia and even deep sedation is there are standards. And from a medical legal standpoint, I think if the standard wasn't followed, especially in a general anesthetic where end-tidal CO2 is the standard, I think we put our providers in a precarious situation. I'm kind of in the same camp as Ali. If we have end-tidal CO2 as a requisite, it doesn't preclude the provider from adding a ventilatory monitor such as the pretracheal stethoscope. But you could also argue the other way around. You know, you hear noise with the patient's attempt to breathe, moving the diameter. It could be fluids, it could be whatever. And assuming that is actually movement of air and not see end-tidal tracing. So I think it can go both ways, but I think we get into kind of deep water when we say that end-tidal CO2 is optional with general anesthesia with the 1301.
Yeah, I guess my argument is not really, and it's not really general anesthesia, it's more deep sedation. You know, sometimes you're in moderate to deep sedation case, and you know, they're not, it's just not sampling. You know, your monitor's there. You're just, for whatever reason, I put a plus sign there if I get in it, a little bit of tracing or something, but I'm heavily dependent on my pretracheal stethoscope. And it's not a hill to fight this much on. I'm just saying that it just interesting to me that we're saying just say ventilatory monitor, but we're not saying that in another sense with the deep sedation where I can see that someone could argue that would be the best ventilatory monitor for a certain situation.
Right. 1301 includes deep sedation and general anesthesia, right? Those levels of sedation.
Right, right. And that's where it kind of gets into the nuances of it.
Right. I don't know. I think this is one of the things we'll have to vote on as a committee.
So Jason,
I'm not that opposed to it. It doesn't really matter to me. I'm just saying it just is something to think about, you know, when we're doing this. Because we're taking out end-tidal, which I agree with the 1302 permit, the pretracheal stethoscope, whatever ventilatory monitor, one or the other, but you're having one or the other.
Jason, are you recommending that we do the same with 1301?
Yeah, that would be my recommendation. But, you know, they're going to have to document that, and they have to show that they're actually using a pretracheal stethoscope, just like they would with end-tidal. And I'm not saying that, like, you shouldn't be sampling end-tidal and writing down values when you're doing a general anesthetic. It's just that because the permit is clumped together with deep sedation, you know, I can tell you there's been deep sedations where the pretracheal stethoscope is the ventilatory monitor of choice. Not always the case, but there's an argument to be made there. But I'm fine saying that both are fine. I think if I was just reviewing, had that type of documentation before that.
Any other committee members have input on whether we should require specifically end-tidal for 1301 or keep it general as a ventilation monitor?
Yes, you need to keep end-tidal for 1301. For 1302 and 1303, it's some type of ventilator monitor. But for 1301, it must say end-tidal CO2. That's what
This is Christensen. I agree. It has to be in there, end-tidal CO2. 1301 permit holders.
Not that I disagree with Dr. Brady at all, but I'm just saying that 1301 must say that.
I agree with these guys as well. I think it's a slippery slope if we don't say that.
I guess my question is, because I do agree with everyone here at 1301 with end-tidal CO2, and I don't disagree with it. I'm just saying, if someone was to review a case of deep sedation, do we just say that, okay, they tried end-tidal CO2, but for whatever reason it was precluded? I know there's some language there that kind of captures that, I think, with the ADA guidelines, with it. Something's precluding that from happening that you've documented or something to that nature. And it may not be worth, I can go back and kind of revisit looking at that, but I agree with everyone. You have to have end-tidal CO2. I'm saying there's certain situations where maybe they should be documenting if something is precluding from the end-tidal CO2 to actually be working. But let's move on. I mean, I'm not trying to change this at this point.
Okay, Jessica, you want to keep us moving along then?
Some of the other changes I made a little further down, I changed it from 8 to age 7 in some of the various sections.
Yeah, I noticed that too, Dr. Lau. Thank you for making that modification.
Did you guys hear me?
Didn't hear you. Just now heard you.
Okay, so we have here B, they have to maintain a staff of supervised personnel capable of handling procedures, complications, and emergency incidents, including at least one staff member who, if you go down to number three, after the procedure monitors the patient until discharge. The suggestion was changing that language to, after the procedure is completed, the patient must be continuously monitored by adequately trained personnel on a one-on-one basis until just discharge criteria has been met.
That's well written, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that.
Making that change?
Yes.
I would agree with that.
Okay. Then that brings us down to number five, provide confirmation of completing coursework within the 2 years prior to submitting the permit application in one or more of the following. B is pediatric advanced life support or PAL. Is required in a practice treating pediatric patients less than 7 years of age. Is it less than 7 years of age, or is it seven or younger?
It is seven and younger. I guess you could phrase that either which way. I'm used to some of the documents saying less than 7 years of age, so either way is fine with me.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So I had a quick question. We were looking over some of this language, I think Monday, that was yesterday, with staff. And if you look at 1302 and 3, based on this, and I'm actually going backwards a little bit. I couldn't raise my hand quick enough. I apologize. But it says right there at the top of this page, it says B maintains a staff and then says holds number or Roman numeral little I, and double I, and then triple I. It looks like on 2 and 3 that the staff member has to monitor the patient until discharge. But if you go back to the 1301, it looks like the dentist has to stay with the patient until discharge. So I didn't know if, so we wanted to bring this up to the committee, and maybe I'm totally crazy, but to me, when I read 1301, the current Q1 says that the dentist can have the following additional persons present with the patient during the critical portion of the procedure. One person has a current certification in PALS or ACLS, one person having a current certification in BCLS or BL, whatever, or ACLS. And then it goes back, and it, instead of staying indented, it says person has a current certification in PALS, blah, 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 who monitors the patient with the patient's oxygen, ventilation, and circulation are stable until the patient meets criteria for discharge until using a recognized pediatric discharge scoring system. And I'm probably reading the 1301P, the new part, but it also occurs in the current rule, the way it reads now under 1301. And for us as staff, it reads that the dentist has to be there till discharge because of the way it's written in rule. I'm trying to find it. To look at all of the current documents that's in the packet. Let's see. Does anybody remember what I'm talking about? And maybe you can help me out. I'm trying to find it real quick. I didn't want to go too far beyond the conversation until just now. And I agree with your comment, Dr. Blazek, that the rule is written in such a way that it looks to me like the other permit holders have staff that can stay there till discharge. But 1301, it appears to me that the dentist has to stay there till discharge, and I'm not sure that we captured it in any revision. And I haven't heard from any staff. Can somebody help me out, please?
Hi, Ryan. This is Sherry. I'm also looking, so just
hang on.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Ryan, are you looking to see if that change was made in as part of these revisions, or are you looking to see what the current rule says?
Well, I know what the current rule says, and so I'm trying to see if we've made the change in these current revisions. We didn't come across it yesterday, but I don't recall having this conversation, and now I'm having trouble even finding it, even in the documents, because of all the redlining and stuff. So that's my struggle right now. Again, I interrupted because I didn't want to go to the next section until we handled this one. At least I thought I'd bring it up, and I could be crazy. So
Dr. Brady, you had your hand up at one point. Did you take that down?
Yeah, I just took it down because I do recall him saying that, but I can't. It is very important for us to find that there. I did copy and paste what the ADA said for ventilation for general anesthesia deep sedation permit holders. That's what I was trying to say earlier.
Do we want to try to search and find this right now, or Ryan, do you want to work on that and we can move along?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I do see in section M under 1301, the permit holder shall not commence with the administration of a subsequent anesthetic case until the patient is in a monitored recovery or meets the guidelines for discharge. I think that's appropriate. It doesn't say that the dentist must stay with the patient until discharge. And I can tell you that's the way it works in most offices is, you know, the surgeon or the dental anesthesiologist or CRNA, medical anesthesiologist, they're going to stay with that patient until they're awake and recovery. The next section does indicate, you know, section N, that the permit holder may work with the dental anesthesiologist. And they must ensure that the healthcare professional continuously supervises the patient from administration of anesthesia or sedation until termination of anesthesia or sedation procedure and oxygenation ventilation and circulation are stable. Again, I think that's appropriate what we're trying to discuss. And that's all it has that I see for discharge. Then it goes to 1302. So I'm not sure what you guys are reading or looking at, but I think what we have is appropriate. And I think it conveys what the majority of us on this committee that do this type of anesthetic would consider safe and the right way to do it. So move on.
Yeah, Jessica, you want to keep us moving along then? Dr. Blazek?
I would ask Dr. Hero that there is something I would like to address back in the 1301 permit at some point in time. I don't need to do it now. It in particular relates to the mobile permit. So I'm happy to let Jessica keep moving forward and introduce it as new business at the end or whatever. But I just want to throw it out there, and I want it to be forgotten.
You know, what I think we should probably do, one, let's try to get through all the rules and then spend a meeting going back through, you know, try to be expeditious about it. But I think several people have comments in several areas we've already gone through.
and we can spend a meeting or two to kind of cover all that. But just for the sake of getting through it, let's plug along.
Thank you. Do we lose Jessica or her screen?
Jessica, can you hear us? Ryan, are you able to try to reach out to Jessica?
Yeah, let me shoot her a text. So she appears in the list of names. Brian Thomas.
Yeah, I see her. I see her there and muted, but.
But let me see if I can reach out to her.
Can you guys hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Sorry about that. Somehow I lost video and then I got video back, but then lost audio. And now I think I have both.
So to answer your question, Ryan, Section B maintains a staff. This level of sedation is a lot lighter than the 1301 and 1302 as far as staffing goes. Usually the dentist is with the patient, and then if the procedure put on oxygen, and then the assistant monitors and so on.
Yes. I personally, like, even with Dr. Blazek's comments, I don't disagree at all with anything that Dr. Blazek was saying, and not being an anesthesiologist or even close. I know a bit about this only because of some of the education I've gone through now that through being here. But there was, I think it was written in 1302 and 1303. And then it wasn't written in 1301. So then the assumption, if you wanted to jump to an assumption, is that the dentist had to be present. But I think I can't find exactly what we were looking at yesterday. And maybe the assumption that we jumped to yesterday, and I probably was the one that led our whole staff leading to believe this. It's probably not an issue. We're looking right now, and I'm still going back to the same thing even Dr. Blazek has mentioned just now about they can't take on another case, yada, yada, until the person's in recovery and whatever. So I think it's fine. If I find something, I'll bring it up, but I won't bring it up again today because I think that I've taken too much time already away from what you guys were doing. So I'll just let Jessica move along.
So I think that brings us to number five, provide confirmation of completing coursework within the 2 years prior to submitting the permit application in one or more of the following. But it looks like B is actually saying that it's not one or more of the following in the case of a pediatric practice. In that case, the PALS is required.
It's required in those treating patients less than 7 years of age.
So it's not an option if they're in a practice treating pediatric patients 7 years or younger, then they have to have the PALS. They don't get the option of
Yeah, that's what the subcommittee recommends.
Okay. And then let me understand correctly, if they are not practicing or treating pediatric patients 7 years or younger, then they can still have a choice. They could have PALS instead of the CPR.
I think by our rules, they would just need CPR.
Okay, so I would suggest
that's all the other roads, the board's rules. We put this in just for that group of seven and younger.
Okay, so then I would suggest parsing this out, leaving number five, essentially saying that they have to have basically number A. And then having a separate section that says that if they are treating pediatric patients, then they have to have B. Because it doesn't really sound like they're getting a choice. It sounds like if they're treating pediatric patients, they need PALS, period. And if they're not, then they don't need PALS, and they actually should be having the CPR, not PALS.
I would... Think
that kind of gets tricky because you know part of me thinks you probably should have PALS if you're treating like the 8 to 12 year group, but I don't know. I'll open up to the committee what everybody's thoughts are. I don't have a problem with two sections there, Jessica. I think that's not a bad idea. I'm just trying to figure out how we're going to word everything.
Randy?
Yeah. So this is Blazek. Yeah. So I think that if you're a 1302 permit holder, they need more than CPR. So you said CPR twice or like that. They need ACLS. Okay. Cause they're doing moderate sedation. So they don't need CPR. They need ACLS. Now their staff, they can have, CPR, BLS, same thing, healthcare provider level. And then I do agree. I think for people, doctors treating patients 7 years of age or younger should have PALs, and therefore I would suggest that it is a different section. I would think that 5 could read as it currently does, that they may have either or, ACLS or PALS, if you're treating people 8 years of age and older. And then section 6 would be, if you're treating pediatric patients 7 years of age or younger, then you must have PALS. That's how I would interpret our discussions have been in the past.
Heath? I have a question that was brought up, and I think it needs to be maybe more clearly stated here. We have defined 1303 to be moderate sedation. So the level between a 1303 and a 1302 can be exactly the same. So why would we have a 1302 require ACLS and the 1303 not require ACLS if the level of sedation is identical between the two with the way we've written them out?
Randy?
I would agree, Heath, but we haven't really gotten to, we talked about 1303 at the last meeting, and Dr. Caputo was very, I had a lot of input about that. But I think when we get to the 1303, but that's, if we're going to change the definition to moderate sedation by via oral route, that I thought was what the difference we were using, where this is interoral.
No, this is I think we're in the 1303 section, are we not?
Yes, this is interoral sedation.
This is interoral. Oh man, I'm looking at the wrong page. No, I'm on 13. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought we were, no wonder I'm reading so many things so wrongly. I apologize.
I just think that's one thing that we get into, that we're going to be sensitive to when we have defined the 1303 provider as a moderate sedation provider, that the level of sedation to me is what presents a lot of these rules as to why we have them or why we don't have them to keep the public safe. And if we're saying that a 1303 is a moderate level of sedation, then to me, it lines up with it's the moderate enteral, moderate parenteral sedation or IV in 1302.
Dr. Blazek?
Yeah, I'm finally catching up with the, I didn't, let me leave my hand up. I'm sorry. Yeah, there we go.
But I think we kind of need to touch base on what Dr. Blazek said about either having ACLS or PALS for treating patients 8 years to 12 years of age using moderate or interim moderate sedation. I think that's pretty good, actually. And I think that kind of goes with what you said, Heath, for the safety of the public. I think that might actually be a nice addition. So then we'd have three different sections, I guess.
So are you suggesting a separate section then for 8 to 12?
I think for the safety of kids, I think it's a good idea.
I can put that in there. What that'll leave you with then, or the question I guess I have then is for number 5, are we still saying that they can have a choice between A and B?
I think if you go to A, it's for patients older than age 12. Then you would have a section B that would be ACLS or pediatric advanced life support is required in practice treating pediatric patients age 8 to 12. And then pediatric advanced life support is required in a practice treating pediatric patients less than 7 years of age.
So all three then would be mutually exclusive?
I think so. I think that would read better.
And is ACLS the same as what's in A or no?
No, that's just the healthcare provider level is in A.
Okay.
Heath? So I just want to, just a question for the committee. For 1302 in this same section that we're speaking of right now in Marion 1302, it says that the provider must provide confirmation of completing coursework within 2 years prior to submitting the permit application in one or more of the following, and then it requires ACLS. Not just CPR. Since a 1303 permit holder, we're permitting them to do the same level of sedation that the 1302 permit holder is. With the level of sedation, do we need to require, be consistent, that it's ACLS? Or do we go back to 1302 and move it to CPR, basic life support?
Ollie?
I think what Heath's saying is making a lot of sense. It should, since the level of sedation be the same between 1302 and 1303, the language requirements should mirror that. So I would, my suggestion would be ACLS for both.
Dr. Blazek?
That's kind of where I was going inadvertently. I didn't realize I was reading the 1302 permit at the time. But yeah, I think absolutely. If we're going to make them both moderate sedation, regardless of route, then they have to be prepared for the untoward or unexpected paradoxical effect of an oral medication, and they have to be able to treat the patient. And that would be, to me, at the level of ACLS.
Heath?
So this adds a lot more complexity, but I feel for the individuals who I think are actually the majority of 1303 holders, permit holders, that do minimal sedation. They don't do moderate sedation with this level. And I feel like we're making it very, very, very difficult for these individuals who have no intention of doing moderate sedation, but because it's lumped into this one permit, now they're going to have to require all this extra stuff for them to be able to do. So does it make sense to add a separate permit that more or less just mirrors the 1303, but it's a minimal, it's oral minimal sedation instead of oral moderate sedation? Because I think we're going to have a lot of dentists, pediatric dentists that don't do moderate sedation with oral sedation that are going to be wrapped up in all of this logistics that we're creating here.
Ollie?
Yeah. But they can, a dentist can do light oral sedation without any permit at all. So for those people that just want to do light sedation, right? I forget, where they can do a total one dose and then repeat with half a dose, and they don't even need a permit.
Randy?
That's where I was going to go with that, what Ollie just said. So I think that's what defines minimal sedation.
I'd like to hear Dr. Lout's opinion on that with the pediatric dentist, because a lot of pediatric.
Well, I know. I agree with the minimal sedation. I agree with that, what you were saying, what Ollie was saying. But I think when you start looking at the drugs that some of the pediatric dentists do and some of the the general dentist or other specialist for oral sedation, you're talking things like triazolam. Some people literally use lorazepam. And I think Versed's safe, but I think that's a pretty strong medication again. So I think a lot of these kind of fall in between minimal to moderate. And, I kind of think that's a good idea. The minimal sedation is like Ollie said, that's for the guy to give one pill of diazepam or hydroxyzine or something like that. But I think when you start giving some of the other agents, especially the opioids and the stronger benzodiazepines, I think you're looking more towards moderate sedation. Now, certainly I'm preaching to the choir here, but I think in concerns of the kids, I think if you're going to do moderate sedation on an 8 to 12 year old, you at least should have a little something more than CPR provider level.
Dr. Arnell, you got your hand up?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I originally, as it was written before all the review, it was enteral, parenteral, and then general anesthesia, deep sedation, correct? And then there was a shift to go to minimal, moderate general anesthesia, deep sedation. It seems like now, I mean, those are two separate paradigms, right? It seems like now we're trying, or not we, I shouldn't say we, I'm not on the committee, but it seems like trying to combine those two paradigms into one system is going to be very complex, because we're also the committee is also giving pediatric endorsements to all of these, but now we're suddenly going to say that any dentist can minimally sedate a pediatric patient via an oral route. I think it's just getting, it's going to get very complex if we try to combine the two paradigms. I think it would be much easier to say a permit for minimal sedation, which is what most of the pediatric dentists are doing on pediatric patients, and a permit for moderate sedation and a permit for general anesthesia, deep sedation. Otherwise, you're going to have dentists all over the place wanting to, quote unquote, minimally sedate pediatric patients and think it's okay that they don't need a permit. That was all I had to say.
Thank you, Doctor.
And another option is just stick with what we have here.
I think that probably works too.
Yeah, I agree. I think maybe sticking with what we have is going to be best. So you want to go with this and move forward?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with this.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So do we still want to parse out that the pediatric requires the PALS and then leave everything beyond pediatric to require just CPR or PALS?
I think this is written pretty well, to be honest with you. It just lists that all this stuff is needed. But if you're going to go 7 or younger, which is a whole different animal, I think you've got to have pediatric advanced life support.
So I think it would be clearer if we pull out the pediatric and say that if it's pediatric, you're required to have PALS, period.
Correct.
Which leaves the group that is beyond pediatric, so 8 or older. And is that just CPR or CPR or PALS? Or is it CPR or ACLS or PALS?
I'd say CPR or ACLS.
Okay. Okay, and so for people who are 8 and older, PALS is not an option.
It is not required.
Correct. Provide confirmation of completing coursework within the 2 years prior. So they have to submit confirmation that they have done either CPR or ACLS for anyone older than 8. Younger Correct. Requires PALS only.
Correct.
Ollie?
Okay.
I was just going to say, personally, I think that they should have to have ACLS if they're performing moderate sedation. CPR is pretty basic. And then also, regarding what you're asking, Jessica, PALS wouldn't qualify somebody to sedate an adult. They'd have to
Would
have.
Not?
No. Like, you couldn't.
Okay.
You couldn't say PALS is okay. My personal position, you shouldn't be able to say you can just have PALS, and with PALS, you don't need anything different for treating an adult patient. And I don't think CPR is enough. I think it should have to be ACLS for adults and PALS for kids. But I don't know what the rest of the group feels.
Well, that's the question. How does the rest of the committee feel?
I just feel like it needs to be consistent. So I could argue CPR, ACLS, but whatever is decided, I think it needs to be the same since the level of sedation is the same. I don't think it's any – I think we fall into the trap that the general I would say general population of dentists doing sedation falls into, that somehow oral sedation is less than IV. And that's not the case. It's the level of sedation is what determines a lot of these rules that we're writing. And so if we're allowing people to do moderate sedation orally and we're requiring the people that are doing it parenterally to do ACLS, then I just don't see why that. It's not consistent because it's the level of sedation matters. But if you said CPR is fine for this, and I would say then CPR should be fine for parenteral moderate sedation as well. I think it just needs to be consistent is my main point.
So I can go back and make these consistent if that's what the committee wants to do. So that would be the secondary question to whether or not this should be CPR or ACLS.
Jason.
Well, I mean, CPR, BLS, same thing. You have to have that as a precursor to have ACLS or PALS. So it's an and, it's not an or for those. And I agree with both Heath and Ali on this one. I think that they should be to that level of training for rescue, because that's what we're talking about, at a moderate level sedation, and it should be consistent. And if it's adults, have ACLS and BLS, and if it's peds, have PALS and BLS.
Does anybody object to that? Because it sounds like most people are saying the same thing at this point. So, Jessica, it sounds like, you know, we could make them consistent with ACLS or PALS depending upon the age.
Okay. So what I've got is we're going to make it – either way, we're going to make it consistent with 1302, and we're going to say pediatric requires PALS. Anything beyond pediatric, it can be CPR or ACLS.
CPR and ACLS. It's not an or. It's an and.
So we would want to change then 5 to say in each of the following, and then list CPR and ACLS.
Dr. Arnell.
I just have a quick suggestion. I think anywhere where it says CPR, it should be changed to BLS because, you know, your babysitter can go take a CPR course. That's not the same thing as BLS. Just as, I mean, since it's going to be written into law, I think it should say BLS, not CPR. That was it.
Thank you.
I agree.
What is BLS?
Basic life support.
And would all the rest of that be the same then? So instead of reading cardiopulmonary resuscitation healthcare provider level from the American Heart Association or all of those other agencies, instead it would read basic life support healthcare provider level?
Yep.
Okay, so we will change, we will change CPR throughout to the basic life support. And then we will change in this rule and in 302 to read in each of the following, and it will include the BLS and the ACLS. And then we'll have a separate section that says that any pediatric requirements has to be PAL. Was there any further discussion on that one?
No, not by me. This is Blazing.
I think you can move on, Jessica.
All right. That brings us to C. Both Dr. Lau and Dr. German suggest removing C completely, which is a recognized continuing education course in advanced airway management.
Keith.
Jessica, I think if you're saying you need, if you're changing the wording to you need each of the following, then that could be removed. But I think it should stay as an option. If we're not requiring that have each of the following, but one, I don't know, like in 1302, that's what I think. Right now, there's no mention of BLS or CPR because, as Dr. Briggs said, if you get ACLS, you have to have BLS. So I don't see why we're even stating that, both of those options. I would just prefer we copy what's in 1302 that we already did and put it in here. And that's option A, B, ACLS, and then option C, a recognized continuing education course.
Okay, so then not adding ACLS here, or in 302?
No, so, sorry, I'm confusing. So if you look back at 1302, this same thing, confirmation provide completing coursework within the 2 years prior to submitting the permit application in one or more of the following. Letter A is ACLS. Letter B is PALS, which we're removing this and making it its own. And then letter C is a recognized continuing education course in advanced airway management. So I think as that's written there, I would just copy that and it should suffice for this. I would think. It's my personal opinion.
And so remove CPR completely.
Yes.
I'd agree with that, Dr. Snell.
So you're still in the same situation where you could have somebody who does just PAL, even though they're treating someone who is not a pediatric patient.
No, yeah, so that's what I'm saying. I like your suggestion to take the pediatric portion and make it its own. And I would actually that's one of the things when we go back through that we might want to consider back in the 1302 as well, because that makes a lot of sense.
Okay. So still take out PALS and make it its own in 1302 and here, and then reword this to match what's left otherwise in 1302 that says ACLS, not CPR, or recognized continuing education in advanced airway management. So it would, if we write it like that, that would allow someone taking pediatrics out, allow someone who's treating not pediatric patients to get either ACLS or a recognized continuing education course in advanced airway management.
Yes, I think that was the intention when we did the 1302 one.
Okay. And is that what the committee wants to do?
Yeah, I want to go back to see a recognized continuing education course in advanced airway management. I think that's great, but I think you got to know about the drugs too, and the ACLS and PALS. And I think that's, I can't speak for John, but that was one of the reasons I thought that was misplaced there. I don't think it should be added there.
Randy, are you talking about the airway, advanced airway management?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
So if we take out the pediatric, right, and leave that all by itself, what we're left with is one or more of the following, which right now in 1303 is CPR or a recognized continuing education course in advanced airway management. If we change the CPR to ACLS, then we're left with ACLS or a recognized continuing education course.
Well, we'll have BLS, health provider, and then we'll have pediatric advanced, ACLS, and then we'll have the PALS. But then we'll take out the recognized continuing education course, because the way it reads, you can do any of those to get your 1303. And I think you got to have one of the ACLS or PALS. I think some people read this and they'll go right to the advanced airway management course and not do the other two.
Correct. So if you want them to have to do at least PALS for pediatrics or ACLS for anyone who's not pediatric, then we have to reword it. And it's not one or more of the following. It's
right.
You have to have
right.
ACLS, and you have to have, and then separately would be pediatrics, you have to have PALS.
Right.
Is that
and
what
then
we're
delete.
Looking for?
Yeah, and then obviously delete the recognized continuing education course in advanced airway management.
Heath?
I just want to, when we were talking 1302, the thought of the committee was that advanced airway course could take the place of ACLS. Is that no longer the desire of this committee?
Well, again, my focus was more on pediatrics than anything, Heath, and I think that I that's probably why
yeah.
I overlooked that. I can't speak for John, but I think that's why in this section we went with taking away the recognized continuing education course. And I guess for what you're saying, we may consider taking that out of the 1302 as well.
And I get that from pediatric standpoint,
yeah.
Because
but I'll leave it up to the committee. If you want to leave in 1302, it's not going to upset me. But I think here, especially with the peds, I think we may need to focus on the medications as well.
Dr. Lott would be so. Yeah. My question would be why wouldn't we put that leave that suggestion here where it's more referring to individuals outside the pediatrics, since we're setting aside the pediatric for its own situation, and you could include that definition or that defining that an advanced airway course is not sufficient if you're doing peds, but if it's adults, then it is sufficient.
I think it just goes to what we said earlier, the one or more of the following, and that's why it was included in there. But I think if you're working on kids, I think you got to focus on that. Airway is important. Don't get me wrong. It's a lot of times it's respiratory on kids, but I think people will bypass that, go right to the airway management, not worry about ACLS or PALS. Now, certainly with what we have now, the route that we're going now, as recommended by Jessica, I guess we can go with this as well.
Dr. Blazek?
But I think it has to be in combination with one of the other ones too, ACLS or PALS.
You know, I like the advanced airway courses, but I don't think they take the place of ACLS or PALS. I mean, most of us that have done an advanced airway course, it just really isn't on the same page. I think in terms of, you know, saving someone in a situation that, you know, really needs it. I like advanced airway courses, but I don't know if it should supplant the ACLS.
Dr. Caputo.
Thank you. I'm really confused on the direction you guys are going here. I can tell you that the committee, last time we did this, spent a lot of time on this very recommendation. And I really struggle with this discussion about drugs. I don't know what drugs you're going to administer in ACLS or PALS that are going to benefit you when you have a patient who most likely is having an issue related to airway versus anything else. Particularly children. I mean, it's well established that when children get into trouble, it's an airway issue more often than not than it is anything else. You can argue cardiac with adults, but we're also talking what we're doing in the office. So there's a very specific reason the committee last time wanted this to be an opportunity for a dentist to get training in airway management, which is truly much more appropriate than ACLS or PALS. The other challenge that I think we're struggling with here is there's no ECG requirement for a 1303 or a 1302 permit holder. So I don't know what guideline they're going to follow if they get into an ACLS or PALS algorithm without having an ECG in place to facilitate their management of the patient. And I actually don't know if that opens them up for greater scrutiny because they don't have that level of interpretation. So I think we have to be really careful here, and I would encourage you guys to be really careful here. I understand you may believe that ACLS or PALS are wonderful and this is what we have, but it's not appropriate for what these folks are doing. This is a conscious level sedation that's being performed. And this idea that a patient needs rescue, their rescue is going to be their airway. I'm sorry. I've been doing this long enough. I've seen enough that I don't see folks get into trouble and now they're down into the algorithm of managing a cardiac event, particularly in pediatrics. So there was a very good reason why this was there. It should be an option. Obviously, you guys are new voices and new perspectives. If you take it out, that's your choice. But there's a reason why it's there. And I don't think ACLS or PALS are appropriate substitutes. If someone wants that training, fine, but it's diminished training to begin with unless they're using an ECG while they're doing their procedures. Thank you.
Dr. Blazek. You're muted, Dr. Blazek.
I appreciate the input, but I'm not saying I think an advanced airway course should be taken out. It should not be taken in lieu of. And also, I think some of the background that we've been struggling with here with Dr. Caputo is the idea that we're all of a sudden going to consider a 1302 permit and a 1303 permit as moderate sedation. And the committee is struggling that we're going to tell a 1302 permit, just because you're giving it to them parenterally, you need to have more training or more monitors than a 1303 permit. So that's another aspect that we're having a hard time dealing with to make. If it's moderate sedation, regardless of the route, the requirements should be the same.
Dr. Snell?
I think this just lends more to my, as we go down this road, to differentiate. I think it was Dr. Arnell that was saying we're confusing route and level, and that's making a lot of things more complicated than they need to be. And for example, you think of a 1303 moderate sedation, there's no IV in place, and we're going to make them take ACLS. If they know how to push drugs, how are they even going to push those drugs? They have no clue how to start an IV. They're going to do it intramuscularly. That doesn't make any sense. So
it's very challenging to write rules when the levels of sedation is what we're going off of, but we're doing it also from we're having the definition, we're combining definitions of the root and the level and trying to make that work. And I think we're banging our heads against the wall for one, just, I mean, as an example right there with ACLS and the 1303.
Dr. Caputo.
I think that your point about an IV in place, Heath, is correct as well. That's another situation here. Additionally, we talked about this last time and I realize it might have got missed, but there's a nuanced difference between an enteral moderate and a parenteral moderate. And just so we're clear, you guys are the ones that changed the definitions here. They've always been, and they currently are, moderate sedation permits. The 1303 is not a minimal sedation permit. It's a moderate sedation permit. And the reason why there's a provision in the rules for minimal sedation is to allow those dentists who want to administer minimal sedation to do that without a permit. Otherwise, you get a permit either to do moderate enteral sedation or moderate parenteral sedation. That's always been that way. I don't know if somewhere along the way you guys just didn't appreciate that or realize it, but it's always been that way. The rules have always read that way. This is not a 1303 enteral minimal sedation permit. It is an enteral moderate sedation permit. The difference is the training. It's a lot more challenging and more involved to administer drugs intravenously and manage that than it is to give a patient a pill or maybe two pills or maybe a redose of a pill than it is to train an IV. And that's the reason for the training difference. I think you guys are working way too hard. I think you're passionate about what you're doing and I applaud you, but I think you're trying to make this better when it's pretty good as the way it is. Yeah, there's some cleanup that certainly can be done, but boy, I think you're gonna make it harder on dentists to try to tease it out the way you see it, because I can guarantee you the vast majority of dentists don't see it that way. I'm working with these guys every day, either training them, either in educational programs or working with them clinically or et cetera in the academic environment. So I'm struggling with why you're making it harder, other than maybe there's just a misunderstanding of how they are presenting currently. Thank you.
Comments from any committee members? Heath.
I'd vote to leave the airway management with the way it's written as an option for when we're speaking about adults having oral sedation.
Okay, so you want to make that a motion?
Sure, I'll motion that.
All right, and I'll second so we can get to discussion. Any discussion on that?
Excuse me, this is Jessica. If I could just clarify something real quick. So we're talking about leaving in C. Is that still with the changes to A, going from CPR to ACLS?
My motion would be to leave in letter C, even if we change letter A to include ACLS.
I would support that.
Dr. Caputo.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw it out there for you all to also appreciate. CPR is a licensure requirement. So in order to have a license in the state of Arizona to practice dentistry, you need to be trained in healthcare provider level, CPR, BLS, whatever you want to call it. So that's already there. So I'm not sure why. I mean, if anything, it's duplicated in the rules, which could probably be cleaned up or at least say it's required, but you need it for your license. Thanks.
All right, we have a motion on the table. Heath, why don't you repeat what you're suggesting?
So I move that we keep, number 5C, a recognized continuing education course in the advanced airway management. We keep that there and we move A to include ACLS instead of CPR BLS.
So that 1303 permit holders have to acquire either ACLS or PALS or an advanced airway course. Is that right?
Yes, but I think it's wise to remove the PALS to its own section to clearly define that that's only for pediatric patients, which I thought we had already resolved to do.
Any questions on that motion before we take a roll call? Sherry, why don't you go ahead and get a roll call?
Hero?
Yes.
Bagai? Excuse me. Bagai?
Yes.
Blazik?
Yes.
Brady?
I think he's left, Sherry.
Thank you. Brownstein?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Jermaine?
Yes.
Lout?
Yes.
Snell?
Yes.
Thank you.
Motion passes, none opposed.
Okay, so based on your motion, it will read here and in 1302 that they have to provide confirmation of completing coursework within the 2 years prior to submitting the permit application in one or more of the following, which will be changed to ACLS for A, and we will leave C as the new B. And then we will still be changing CPR and other references throughout the rule to basic life support healthcare level.
Yes.
Well done. Okay. So just to help us, just to help us along in that discussion, I parsed out the PALS and I will likely reword it so that reference to the pediatric patients, the provider and everything like that is consistent. That'll be the new number 6, which will bring us to number 7. In renewal of pediatric endorsement 1303 permit, the practitioner must submit to the board evidence of completion of at least 20 cases of patients 7 years of age or younger in the past 2 years and 15 hours of continuing education training over the past 2 years in areas of pediatric airway anatomy, physical evaluation, medical conditions, pharmacology, sedation, general anesthesia, and medical emergencies.
I thought that instead of providing evidence, we were going to allow an affidavit, or is that the same thing?
I'm fine with affidavit.
We addressed that somewhere, the affidavit. I think for those who are either being grandfathered in or...
Well, we did in the 1301... designation P renewal. I'm pretty sure of that. So I thought the affidavit would be appropriate for this too.
Ryan, do you have any input on that from board staff perspective? I imagine the affidavit would be easier to deal with than having them submit evidence of all the coursework they've done.
I agree. I think an affidavit would be simpler. I honestly don't know. I mean, I'm torn kind of in both ways because sometimes it's better to have everything substantiated so we don't fall into the issue that this board ran into a couple of years back where somebody forged their documentation that they had, training, education, and whatnot. I don't know. I mean, I'm torn. I don't really have an answer. And that maybe Seamus would jump in and give an opinion legally on what's the best thing. I always think direct source is the best way to go, but.
Well, I would verbalize that certainly the easiest thing to falsify in this requirement is that you've done 20 anesthetics on pediatric patients. All you have to do is merely fill out 20 anesthetic records and make up the case. The harder thing to do to falsify would be to provide 15 hours of continuing education. Whatever the, I guess our counsel indicates is appropriate. Just because you have one bad apple, I don't think you should ruin it for the rest of the bunch.
Yeah, I think that bad apples, I mean, why do we all take off our shoes when we go to the airport and take a flight? I mean, that's what happens when you get bad apples. So those bad apples are unfortunate occurrences in our lives, but it's those little things, those nooks and crannies that people find and fill them with their own things. And so, again, I think I'm not saying it's not my decision. An affidavit is clearly the easiest way to go. But I also think direct source, you can actually, you know for certain that the person did what they said that they did. But in this case, it may be inconsequential and just an affidavit would be sufficient, but I'll let you guys make the decision.
Right, Ryan, this is Seamus. I just had a question. Has this board moved over to the Thentia software?
They will move super soon, like within the next month. They'll be on probably by December 15th.
Okay, because it's also my understanding that the if the board were to require that everybody submit those certificates, that Thentia, and this is my understanding, Thentia automatically audits everything, which would save the board a lot of time, and it would be easy to determine whether people have complied or not.
Yeah, it's. I think that that's the cat out of the bag. I think that that's what most boards believe. We certainly do, or the staff does. I'm not sure that the board has been given this information, but we think that all renewals, including anesthesia and sedation, when providing course education, just has to upload the certificates of completion on CE, which would do 100% auditing. So I think it would probably, that's what we've been told. So that's the hope.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Best practice would be to request the primary source documentation. As we know with the affidavit, you don't have to present those certificates to the person who signs off, the notary public, as opposed to if you were to send them in, the board would be able to audit that. Thank you.
Well, with all that said, I might have kind of derailed the momentum we had going, but I thought it was important to get board staff perspective on it. I just kind of echo what Dr. Blazek said. I don't know that it's going to make much difference between the affidavit and the direct material. So I'm fine with an affidavit if that's the consensus of the committee. So why don't we move ahead, Jessica, and allow for an affidavit.
Okay. And I'm assuming that we're still wanting to make that consistent with 1302.
Yes, I would believe so.
Okay.
And 1301, the renewal aspect for 1301, 1302, 1303, in terms of the pediatric designation, should relatively be the same. 20 cases of patients 7 years of age or younger in the past 2 years.
So I realize that throughout a lot of these, we've been saying 7 years or younger. My this may be superfluous, but what if you have someone who is, 7.5? Are you counting that as 7 years of age or younger?
Correct.
You still consider that 7 years.
Correct.
That's until, okay. Until so are we really talking?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm wondering if it might actually be more accurate to say patients younger than 8. meaning if they have not reached their 8th birthday yet, then they would still be considered the pediatric patient.
Good.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, the next question is subsection C. Initial applicants shall meet one of the following. It looks like Dr. Snell had a question. Should this be consistent with level 2 permit requirements if both are allowed to do moderate sedation? I think that question has been answered. Even if not, section should be revised structurally to mimic the outline of level 2 permit with just a 1 and a 2. Section 1 here seems redundant with section 3.
So in section 1 there, I would probably cross out the word undergraduate.
Don't know if I can get sections 1, 2, and 3 on the page at the same time. Okay, so we have, they have to meet one of the following. Number one is successfully completing a board recognized undergraduate, graduate, or postgraduate education within the 3 years before submitting the permit application that includes the following. And then it's 30 didactic hours of basic moderate sedation via an oral route to include physical evaluation, management of medical emergencies, the importance of and techniques for maintaining proper documentation and monitoring and the use of monitoring equipment.
I would change the 30 didactic hours. I would change that to enteral moderate sedation. I would cross out basic and then just put enteral moderate sedation. And I take out via an oral route.
Is that what the committee wants to do?
I'm fine with that.
So instead of basic, we'll put enteral. And I would take out via an oral route. Okay. Again, up there on section one, where it's undergraduate, I would probably take undergraduate out.
So I believe this is all new language. You can see what's in red down here. So it used to say complete a board recognized postdoctoral residency programs that include documented training in oral sedation within the last 3 years before submitting the permit application, or, and then it goes on to number two. So we're now taking out or changing postdoctoral residency program to graduate or postgraduate education. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and we have just an A here. Is there supposed to be a B of some sort?
I don't think so. I think we kind of pasted that in there, and I probably added an A there.
Okay, so we can probably... Okay, so successfully complete board-recognized graduate or postgraduate education within the 3 years before submitting the permit application. That includes 30 hours of enteral moderate sedation, including the following. And then you've got physical evaluation, management of medical emergencies, the importance of and techniques for maintaining proper documentation and monitoring and the use of monitoring equipment.
Dr. Blazek?
Yeah, Dr. Loud, I was just going to ask you, so you guys worded it this way, just, you know, for clarity, so I understand, in the interest that someone that goes to a pediatric residency they're going to get 30 didactic hours, as opposed to a postdoctoral residency program in oral sedation. You took it out. You took that out, so it was kind of misleading. It was almost as if it was a program like a dental anesthesia program or a maxillofacial anesthesia program. Is that why you took that out? Just to
see
that? Okay. All right.
Yeah, that's why we did that.
Okay, so just for clarity, so I understand.
Because there's AGDs and things like that that do a lot of oral sedations, and they see a lot of kids as well.
Okay, and that's where number two comes in. Okay, right. Although, well, we're not to number two yet, right? Or we are?
I think we're just revising one.
Yeah, I'm just cleaning up formatting. If you guys are ready, if you're in agreement with all of these requirements, you can move on to number two.
Dr. Caputo.
I'm just wondering how that is measured for the 30 hours. There's nothing in any of the CODA standards that I'm aware of, and I've reviewed them for pediatric dentistry, AEGD, and GPR, that indicate that the residents actually get 30 hours of training. They do get, there is a requirement, I think, in the pediatric guidelines for the number of patient experiences they're supposed to have, but there's nothing in those guidelines for the actual number of hours. So I don't know how that would get measured and how you could verify that, number one. Number two, putting actual hours in there is inconsistent with what you would see in any other state board requirement, through this particular route of graduate or postgraduate. I don't know what graduate or postgraduate is, I guess, but whatever. That's your guys' call. If it's after they've been in dental school, I guess you're saying they could get this in dental school, which would then be.
That's kind of why we took out undergraduate.
There's no way to measure that 30 hours. That's all I'm saying. So I don't know if you're putting in a requirement that can't be measured. Because then what if the board turns around and says, per this requirement, we need you to document 30 hours, and the person has no way of doing that. So I don't know. It just seems like that's a little much. Thank you.
Heath?
From what I'm reading in number three, and I have to go back to look at what the current law states, but I think number three has been redlined because it was current law. The providing proof of participation in 30 clock hours of board recognized undergraduate, graduate, postgraduate. That's been in there for years.
That was going to be my comment, Dr. Snell. And I'd also indicate, I mean, I know for our training, I talked about anesthesia, and you have to do 3 months. It doesn't say hours, but it says 3 months of anesthesia training. It's not hours, but it's indicated that you have a certain amount of time that you spend in anesthesia. So my thought would be, and I'm not familiar with the CODA regulations that you refer to, Dr. Caputo, but that CODA it essentially indicates that if you're in a pediatric residency, I'm sure there's some kind of language that indicates that if you're going to get a permit for anesthesia, then there's a certain amount of training. I don't know. Maybe you could expound on that. Maybe there's not. I don't know.
I can speak on my own.
I think for the sake of everything, we can take out the 30 hours. And it would not hurt my feeling whatsoever.
God bless you.
So do we want then to leave one as is and not include 30 hours, or should it be a different? You want to reference it some other way?
I would just take out the 30 hours.
And say training in basic moderate sedation. I know Dr. Snell has his hand raised.
Training of enteral moderate sedation, including the four listed there.
Do you want to change education to training?
30 hours. I would just say submitting the permit application that includes training of enteral moderate sedation, including.
Do you want it to be an affidavit?
That would work.
Okay.
Dr. Snell?
So my question would go back to 1302. I apologize. I don't know 1301 as well, but I think it's kind of a mute point because that's going to be your dental anesthesiologist and OMS guys anyways. So, but the 1302, we have a requirement for 60 hours. Is Dr. Hero, Dr. Caputo proposing that there's no requirement for 60 hours in a AEGD course as well that gives them IV training, and we take that out as well?
Yeah, so, I mean, just to be clear, Heath, I mean, this is not me. I'm just telling you what the standards say. And there's nothing in the standards about hours. You're absolutely correct. To Dr. Blazek's point, he's right. Oral surgery has a three-month requirement. Pediatric dentistry has a one-month requirement in the OR. Those are specific times that are set up. If you ever look at the anesthesia standards, they're very specific on the variety of experiences that the anesthesia residents have to have, including length of time, as well as types of procedures and airway management that they have to be exposed to. But if you look at AEG, I would imagine perio and endo are the same, but I have not looked at those standards recently. I can tell you I am familiar with pediatric AEGD and GPR, and there's not an hour requirement. Generally speaking, the only thing that those programs go towards, including pediatric, are a certain number of cases that the residents have to participate in. But there's no hour requirement in the standards.
So my question would be, is that what we want to move in forward to Arizona? Do we want it just to be a number of cases of patients treated? Because it's easy for someone to just give a half a, 0.25 triazolam to 15 patients and have no real understanding of what they're doing.
Yeah, and I think that's the challenge.
And they call, I got 15.
I think that's the challenge with the enteral permit, right, is there's really, and that's why I think it's appropriate that there's not a patient requirement versus one that is there for parenteral. So I completely understand your comment, but I think one of the things that you might be trying too hard to do, even though I understand it, is make an equivalence between enteral and parenteral, because there is a distinct difference, and I really want you to embrace that, because there is, and maybe not the time here, but I'd love to sit down with you sometime and talk about it, because it's a distinctly different thing. I've been teaching enteral sedation for several years. It's not IV. I have taught IV. There's a tremendous amount involved in teaching IV that you don't need to do or cover in enteral. It's just a different process. And so to include a patient requirement, I think, would not be beneficial or appropriate. I think to teach a dentist the background and I think the proper word or a good word that was suggested by Dr. Lout was training and understand these drugs is appropriate, and the way we're doing it currently absolutely meets this mark, I think, very, very well. Thank you.
Dr. Arnell?
So the discussion so far has been focused on residencies and AEGD programs, and these programs last a year or 2 years or 3 years or longer, but we have to remember that these rules also have to apply to people who don't do any of those longer programs, but essentially go take weekend courses on sedation. And yes, I agree, saying 30 hours really has no value to someone who did a residency or an AEGD, but it does give a bare minimum standard to say whether a weekend course is acceptable.
Yeah,
or not.
I think to answer your question, Matthew, I think later on in the document, we've kind of listed the criteria for people that have taken weekend courses, because this is kind of a nationwide thing. And some other states have kind of addressed that. We mentioned things like 60 hours of continuing education, these various topics, as well as like 25 cases that have been completed with monitoring from another person. So I think we've listed that later on.
Okay. All right. Yeah, thank you. I wasn't aware of that, but I do think there is some value in making sure that there's a little bit of a safety net to define that there needs to be some kind of a bare minimum standard for these weekend courses to be acceptable. That was all. Thank you.
Keith.
Dr. Laut, can you point to where that's at? Because as I look forward a few pages, I don't see that anywhere. And so I don't.
Well, it's somewhere. It's somewhere. Yeah, it's somewhere in here. I couldn't tell you exactly where it is, but I know that we'd put it in there somewhere. It might be in the early part of the document. But I can't pinpoint right now. I know that we put it in there. Me and Lisa Beanstalk put it in there.
We're going to have to start wrapping up in about 15 minutes. Jessica, is there a stopping point you feel is appropriate?
let me see. Because I don't think you guys have finally hammered out C1 yet, unless I've missed something in your conversation.
I was hoping we were going to make it to the start of the 1304 and the 1303.
There it is, Heath, highlighted in yellow. There's the recommendation.
Okay, so that's just speaking specifically for pediatrics, though. Is that
correct?
Okay?
I've not addressed that for adults, no.
Depending on how quickly we can get through C.
Yeah, 1302, I don't believe, has this in there.
I'm just wondering, with Dr. Arnell's point, if we're addressing the weekend people that are taking a weekend course, does the committee want to
so these are the requirements for initial application.
If we take it out of, yep, and that's for if they do a CE course or if they've done a residency, they'd be an initial applicant.
Correct.
As the law stands right now, it's always been 30 hours. But if the board, if the committee wants to take that out, that's...
Well, we had looked at other states, Heath, and I can't speak for the adult, but I know some of the California's one, Texas is one, that have increased it to 60 hours so that people can't take a weekend course. They got to do a little bit more and they got to have proof that they've completed some cases. I assume that would be the intention of 1302 as well.
Yeah, 1302 already has 60 hours as the bare minimum.
Is that the initial? What's the renewal?
The renewal, I'd have to look at the CE hours. I don't remember the renewal off the top of my head, but it's, yeah, the initial is 60 hours.
Dr. Caputo.
I'm just wondering, just going to Dr. Laut's point, of what other states are doing. Did you see how they determined how 60 hours in enteral sedation was being provided? I mean, again, I've been doing this for several years.
Yeah, I couldn't.
Able to get 30 hours.
Yeah, Anthony, I couldn't give you the specifics, but, you know, it's a lot of places, a lot of there's been some problems in children. And a lot of states have kind of adopted that. Why it's 60 and not 50, I don't know, but that seems to be a pretty good point. I think you have to have a little bit more training than taking a weekend course.
Well, even with a weekend course, if that's what we're calling it, I mean, 30 hours is beyond a weekend. I think 30 hours has worked well. And I think it's appropriate. I also would be, a little critical of the cases. 25 cases is more than what they're requiring for parenteral. They only require 20. And I just don't know where someone's going to get a 25 case experience. There's not a lot of courses that do that currently, particularly in the area of enteral sedation. I think that's a big leap. I've always applauded our state for what it does in this area. I think it's very appropriate. I'd love to see statistics in terms of outcomes that would impact that differently. My understanding is our outcomes with respect to enteral sedation are pretty darn good. And I don't necessarily correlate more training with being safer. So, but anyway, thank you.
Dr. Blaze.
I was just going to echo, I agree. I saw the discrepancy about 25 versus a 20, and I thought we should be consistent. That was about all I was going to mention to that effect. I would say I think advanced training does equate with safety, and I would also indicate that I think daily use of anesthetics leads to a culture of safety. But I certainly don't think there's any outcomes out there to prove otherwise.
Dr. Snell?
I think there's a little, at least I'm hearing some disconnect between the what's being recommended here. So Dr. Lau has wonderfully put in item number 4, which is specific to pediatrics. And those hours are specific to pediatrics. The number of cases are specific to pediatrics. What we were talking about before with the 30 hours is just simply non-pediatric cases. So those individuals that go take a CE course or that have done a residency or whatever in their initial application, as it has been for a long, long, long time, they need to provide proof of 30 hours of this training. And then there's no case requirement, no number of patients requirement. It's never been that way. I think what I'm suggesting is we just leave it as it's been with the 30 hours, the training as it is for those initial applicants. And then if you want a pediatric designation, then that's where the number of cases comes involved and the additional hours become involved because it's the kiddos that are under 8 years old. That's the way it's been in law currently. So if we want to change the 30 hours for everybody, take that completely out, I suppose we can, but there needs to be a distinction that we're talking about two different things. One is non-pediatric providers, and then one are those that are providing to pediatrics.
Jessa, what are your thoughts right now?
So we're just talking about the initial applicant, right? We address the pediatric issues further so down. This would just be changing what is already currently
for
done.
Initial applicants who have never been licensed before.
Yes. These are for the people that have not completed a residency, postgraduate training. The 60 hours.
But those 60 hours are just for pediatric, Dr. Lau, correct?
Correct. Yes, so, this was just pediatric.
So item number C1, that's not for pediatric patients. This is for everybody else that's not treating a pediatric patient. So in C1, all we did was rewrite C1 as to what was already there in number 3 to make it consistent with what's in 1302 as far as the hours are different. It's only 30 instead. 60, but all the other verbiage is similar.
Correct.
So what I'm getting at is I think we should keep it as it's been in law at 30 hours. And these are the course material that would be consistent with those, with that training. And this would be for someone who's doing an AGD, a GPR, a perio, a weekend course. I know in my AGD, I had proof that I had 60 hours of coursework from Dr. Ernie Luce on what we talked about. And I think that's very easy to provide coming out of a CE course or a postdoctorate or postgraduate course.
And I'm perfectly fine with that on adults.
Dr. Lau, what are your thoughts about the 25 versus 20 patients?
I think 20 is fine.
So, Jessica, for consistency, maybe we can clean that up as well.
Okay, you're referring to the minimum of 25 patients?
Yeah, 20.
Changing that.
20 is fine.
In number 2, change it to 20? Okay.
Yeah.
And then do you want to keep the suggested language for number 1, or do you want to keep the current language for number 1?
Dr. Lout, do you have an opinion on that?
I think it reads pretty good right now. Of course, I'm being a little biased, but I think it reads pretty well with the changes.
Yeah,
I agree.
Okay, so go with the blue language for number one.
Correct.
Okay. So the initial applicant has to either complete the following enteral moderate sedation training, which includes physical evaluation, management of medical emergencies, the importance of and techniques for maintaining proper documentation and monitoring and the use of monitoring equipment. Or then we move to number two, an applicant who completed training in moderate sedation, and I assume we're taking out via and adding in enteral.
Enteral moderate sedation.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like you'll be doing the same thing on A there.
Okay. More than 3 years before submitting the permit application shall provide the following documentation. And then A says on a form provided by the board, a written affidavit. Does the board provide the affidavit or a form?
I don't know.
Dr. Caputo, you got a comment?
I just was going to point out, I mean, seems kind of backwards to me, but you have an approach in pediatric sedation, enteral sedation, of typically one dose and you're done. You administer that dose to the patient, it either works or it doesn't. And that's how most, if not all, programs train. If that process doesn't work, it's considered a failure and you determine a different way to treat that patient. Versus with enteral sedation and adults, we talk about redosing, possibly giving an additional dose of a drug with the initial drug effect that we wanted to have. So it seems like we're just making it hard. I don't know why we're making it harder to do pediatric sedation.
Well, we have it. I don't want to interrupt you, Anthony, but we do have it earlier in the document. We have something about redosing.
But it doesn't happen in pediatrics.
What's that?
It doesn't happen in pediatrics. Very rare.
Right. It was a note to not redose.
Right. So, but you want this person to have 60 hours of training to give a dose of drug. If it doesn't work, figure something else out. I'm not wrapping my head around that.
No, that's obviously practitioner's decision.
Okay. Well, all right. I just think you're making the requirements a lot harder for someone to obtain a permit that currently does it and they do it very safely without, basically, you're requiring twice the amount of education and then a whole new area of, I don't know where they're going to go and get this.
I'm representing the constituents on this a lot too, but what are you doing a sedation on a 3-year-old? And the person's had 30 hours of continuing education.
Okay. You're going to tell me that they do it all the time. It's what we're currently doing.
We're talking about people that haven't had training.
No, right.
I think for the sake of time, you know, let's keep moving along.
Well, all right. I'm just letting you guys know there's going to be some pushback on this and you have to expect that. And I don't know that you're representing your constituents at the same level that you think you are. And I'm not saying this in an argumentative way. I'm just recognizing that. But I appreciate your point.
Good.
Why don't you keep us moving, Jessica?
I think she's maybe offline again or something.
Jessica, can you hear us? Just
you guys hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Sorry, I was muted in one spot and I was showing it unmuted in the other. Okay. So yes, I will change the via oral route to enteral moderate sedation. And I think that concludes 2A. Let's scroll back up to 2B and see. Okay, so nothing else in 2B either. It's changing via an oral route to enteral moderate sedation.
Yeah, just change that.
And then still removing C. Is that accurate?
So this section is speaking specifically for those individuals who are submitting an initial application whose training was done more than 3 years before submitting their application. So letter C is saying that those individuals need a written affidavit affirming the completion of 30 hours of CE taken within the last 5 years. I would think that would be appropriate given the fact that this is specific to those individuals who are submitting their application more than 3 years after having their graduate, postgraduate training.
So are you suggesting keeping three or still removing three?
I would suggest keeping it, but it's been there. I think it's fine. There's no reason to remove it, in my opinion.
Dr. Lau, do you have a comment on that?
No, I didn't do any editing on that area.
So
it reads fine to me.
Doesn't three say the same thing as one?
It does, but one is only if they're before the 3 years. It's within the 3 years.
Okay.
This is.
Yeah.
So you've got the new one that basically mirrors what was in three for someone who's submitting within 3 years of that training. Then you have two, which is someone who's submitting more than 3 years before the application. So I think three is still somewhat redundant of number one now.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought. That's why I like getting rid of it.
Jessica, do you have a suggestion?
If you're going to make those changes in number one, then I don't see a reason to keep number three. There's a couple of things in there. I think pharmacology or maybe training in basic oral sedation. Give me one second.
what about an individual who didn't go to a board recognized program? So how do we address that? Is that number two?
I think they can only go to a board recognized program, or they can provide proof of credentials somewhere else.
In a different state.
Right, or military.
I think two is written for somebody that didn't complete a program, Randy.
Or didn't. Okay.
Hold on. The way number two is written is it's only for those people who are submitting an initial application.
Oh, that's correct.
More than 3 years. So there is nothing in here that gives provisions to someone who has not completed an undergraduate, graduate, or postgraduate education.
That's kind of how I'm reading it, Heath. Yeah. So maybe we need a three who addresses that.
Well, so do they have to complete a board recognized graduate or postgraduate program?
That's my consideration would be to scrap that verbiage. And this is just for initial applicants. So initial applicants, regardless of where you got your training, this is what the training needs to have training in physical evaluation, management, medical emergencies. And that's why I think, and that's the way it's been written forever. That's what number three. So number one used to be this complete a board recognized postdoctoral residency program. That was number one. And then number three was what is currently number three that's striked out. That was reworded to now be number one. So I don't know why we even need to have the board recognized graduate or postgraduate education. I think it should be successfully complete an educational course, or however you want to say that, within the 3 years before submitting the permit application that includes the following enteral moderate sedation training. Da, 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 da.
Jessica, the idea here is that dentists should be able to acquire this permit even if they didn't attend a postgraduate residency program.
If they don't attend the postgraduate residency program, do they still have to get training that is board recognized?
There's a pathway that they should be able to get this permit by taking continuing education courses.
You know, I think we say that in one, because graduate or postgraduate education, that's broad, right? Heath and Randy, we're saying if you took a course in perio or you took a course in peds, or whatever, or after you graduated, you took additional CE courses that satisfy these requirements, then you are a candidate.
Yes.
And those graduate and postgraduate courses have to be board recognized.
Can we say that they're ADA or
CODA, I think is the right term.
Well, no, because if you take CE courses, that wouldn't fall under CODA.
Well, I thought that's what three was about, so taking CE courses.
C reads exactly the same as one. It's the same.
Let me see.
Let me make my screen a little bit smaller so we can get one, two, and three all together.
Well, where are we going to do the 30 hours thing?
That was what was
recommended.
So the two exists for those folks who from another state.
Yeah. You got the C down there on the form provided written affidavit. So
I think really to make it simple is what you should do is if an applicant completed enteral moderate sedation training more than 3 years before submitting their permit application, really what they need to provide is a current, moderate sedation permit from the state that they're applying from, because that state's going to have requirements for that. And if they don't have a current permit, then they would default into most likely number three, which says they have to just get training all over again. But that's what two is there for, is just recognizing the person that's been practicing in another state with their moderate sedation permit, and they're now moving to Arizona. So since they could have been practicing for 10 years, now they're coming here and they just want to transfer those credentials. So really the easiest thing to do is just a the requirement should be a copy of their current moderate sedation permit. If they don't have that, then they have they default to three.
Dr. Blazek?
You're muted, Randy.
I got you. I like what Dr. Caputo said there. And in fact, I wonder, and again, I hate making things more complicated, but should we have a provision in here that indicates, you know, if you fail to recertify or renew in Arizona, or if you come in from another state and you are not current on your permit, then absolutely, like Dr. Caputo insinuated, you go back to zero and you have to start over. Or is that not necessary? You know, people should just understand, hey, if you're not doing anesthesia every year and you're not getting your permit renewed every year, then you should just go back and start over with CE and everything. I mean, should we have a provision in here that indicates that?
I would think by default, it says that if there's the three pathways, if you completed a postgraduate residency that meets the requirements, that's one pathway to acquiring the certificate. Second pathway would be you have an active certificate in another state. Third pathway would be that you've taken the required CE courses to meet the requirements.
Would it?
So if you don't meet one or you don't meet two, then you immediately are going to fall to three.
I would make a recommendation. If it's okay with you, Heath, would it be okay for the committee if me and Heath kind of tweaked this a little bit?
Yeah, I think that'd be great.
I think that might be a little easier than going back and forth because I think we've got all the idea what we need to do. We just need to kind of refine everything and do that for the latter two options that you discussed, Anthony.
Okay. I think that's great. And I think everybody's on the same page as what we need to accomplish. It's just about making sure the language reflects that.
I just wanted to add one more thing, Anthony.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
So when you guys are looking at this, my point is the only reason why I would challenge the language that's currently here is what if a state has a different requirement than we do for that person to maintain their permit? So they've been following their state's requirements for however many years. So I think requiring a current sedation permit would just be the way to go. So that's why I'm throwing that out there as you guys are doing your consideration offline. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Are you comfortable with that, Heath?
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Lau.
Okay.
Okay, well, I think we're going to wrap it up here. Appreciate everybody's time, and we'll see you guys at the next meeting. Now, go ahead, Randy.
One quick thing. I mentioned this to Yasmin. The next meeting is the same day as Mission of Mercy, and I typically go to that. I don't know about Dr. Christensen, and certainly I'm not required for the committee, but there might be others who also attend that event. I just think we should consider that or try to get an early quorum before we decide on that meeting date. So that's, I think, the 9th. I'll look real quick on my phone here. I don't know if anybody was aware of that. Yeah, December 9th is the next meeting from 2:30 to, 4:30 or 5:30, and that is the first day of Mission of Mercy.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Jessica.
This is Jessica. For what it's worth, I will not be available on the 9th.
Well, there's a deal killer.
All right, well, Ryan, maybe Yasmin could send out some alternate dates, and we can poll the members to see what works.
Okay. We'll probably move it to the Friday since we haven't had a Friday. So maybe the 16th or whatever. Real quick, are you guys comfortable with those other dates that are proposed for 23? It's hard. If you had any objections, hopefully you would know them by now.
March 10th might be hard for me.
And everyone, that's a spring break week, so probably a lot of people are out of town.
Yeah.
You know.
We can get rid of the March meeting altogether, just do January, April, May.
Did you say we can do all the meetings all together?
No, just the March one. Yeah, we could do that. We'll pass it on to you.
All right, well, Ryan, we've got a pre-board meeting after this. Let's call it. Let's try to start it in about 20 minutes, so like 5:20, if that's all right.
Okay, I will let people know.
All right, thank you, everybody. Appreciate your time tonight.
Thanks.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thanks for letting me be involved.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Caputo.